In Myanmar have responded to protesters by opening fire at a power plant on Sunday. Meanwhile, the U.S. Embassy in Myanmar urged American citizens to shelter in place, citing reports of military movements in Yangon. It also warned there was a possibility of telecoms interruptions overnight between 1 a.m. and 9 a.m. Armored vehicles rolled into major cities as the new army rulers faced a ninth day of anti-coup demonstrations that saw hundreds of thousands of people participating. Soldiers were deployed to power plants in the northern region, leading to a confrontation with demonstrators, some of whom said they believed the army intended to cut off the electricity. The government and army could not be reached for comment. Monday holds the prospect of two flashpoints for the political standoff, a court appearance by ousted national leader Aung San Suu Kyi, and a possible announcement of the death of a young protester shot last week. The UK government says it has reached its goal of giving at least one COVID-19 vaccine shot to the most vulnerable people in the country. The development increases pressure on ministers to clarify when they will ease a lockdown imposed in early January. Some 15 million people, or 22% of the UK population, have received their first shot or were offered one. The figure includes most people in the government's top four priority groups, including everyone over 75. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's acquittal on charges of inciting a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol has left Democrats and Republicans deeply divided Sunday. Read more on voanews.com. This is VOA News. Kosovars began voting on Sunday in a parliamentary election that an anti-establishment party is expected to win, further complicating Western efforts to resolve the country's decades-long territorial dispute with Serbia. The State Election Commission said turnout by 11 a.m. local time was 8.3%, 1 percentage point lower than in the last election in 2019, mainly due to freezing temperatures. Rescuers pulled out nine more bodies from the site of a flash flood in a Himalayan region of northern India on Sunday, a week after the disaster happened. The death toll is now 50, with more than 150 people still missing, according to officials. The flash flood in Uttarakhand state, triggered by what scientists said could have been a large avalanche of glacier ice, sent water, rocks, and debris surging down the Daliganga River Valley. Dams and bridges were destroyed. Rescuers are using heavy digging machinery in a race to free dozens of dam construction workers trapped in an underground tunnel connected to a hydroelectric project being built by the government-owned National Thermal Power Corporation. Rwanda said on Sunday it has commenced COVID-19 vaccinations with limited supplies of vaccines. The inoculations were acquired through unnamed international partners, and officials said the program had started with frontline healthcare workers. The Central African country has been battling a surge in infections of COVID-19, which has forced the government to reimpose a lockdown last month in the capital, Kigali. Authorities banned movement in and out of the city except for essential services for tourists. In a tweet, Rwanda's Ministry of Health said the country's national vaccination program had begun, quote, vaccinating high-risk groups, notably frontline healthcare workers, with WHO-approved COVID-19 vaccines acquired through international partnerships in limited quantities. Israel plans to reopen restaurants around March 9th and restart tourism with Cyprus. The reopening is part of a gradual return to normality, thanks to a COVID-19 vaccination campaign, according to officials on Sunday. With more than 41% of Israelis having received at least one shot of Pfizer Incorporated's vaccine, Israel has said it will partially reopen hotels and gyms on February 23rd to those fully inoculated or deemed immune after recovering from the virus. Via remote, I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for the New Statesman, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump has begun. After a procedural phase that saw the Senate vote to allow the trial to go forward, the team from the House of Representatives managing the prosecution proceeded to make their case that Trump incited the mob that ransacked and terrorized the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th, leaving five dead, dozens injured, and a democracy shaken to its core. The presentation by the House managers included never-before-seen video that demonstrated just how close the mob came to their self-stated goal of exacting physical harm on elected officials, including former Vice President Mike Pence and current Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. While a handful of Republican senators indicated that they found the prosecution case to be persuasive, the response of most ranged from unconvinced to apathetic, and the prospects for conviction appear to be remote. The U.S. entered a precarious phase of the COVID-19 vaccination effort as providers try to ramp up the number of people getting first shots while also ensuring a growing number of others get the required second doses. Meanwhile, public health officials grappled with how to deal with new strains of the virus that may be increasingly contagious and more dangerous than the original. And House Democrats pushed past Republicans on major portions of President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion relief package. Finally, demonstrators gathered in the streets of Myanmar's capital again Tuesday for a fourth consecutive day, defying a set of restrictions imposed by the military junta aimed at stopping the massive protests against the overthrow of the elected civilian government. Panelists, welcome. Thank you and joining us for, again, what appears to be, seems to be our annual impeachment show, talking about the second impeachment of former President Trump. The Senate began the trial with Trump accused of what Democrats and some Republicans even are calling the most grievous constitutional crime ever committed by a president. The trial has been an emotional retelling of the events leading up to and including January 6th, including a detailed timeline and a map showing the mob getting very, very close to encountering elected officials as they fled the scene of this violent mob. I'm going to start with you, Emily. The trial had to be declared constitutional before actually beginning in the Senate. What was the Republican case for not having a trial at all, given all of the evidence that we know about even before the trial started?
So the Republican case was essentially that because Trump has already left office, he cannot be impeached. Democrats pointed out that there's nothing in the Constitution that says that. And in fact, there is precedent for impeaching officials who have left office. The other irony here is that the reason that the trial started after Trump left office is that Mitch McConnell, when he was Senate Majority Leader, declined to start the trial or have the articles of impeachment at the Senate until January 19th. I saw somebody on Twitter say that their argument boils down to, if delayed by Mitch, you must acquit. And that's basically what it was, right? That the conditions have been set such that the trial had to happen after Trump left office. And therefore, they're saying, oh, well, I guess we can't do it now. Democrats overrode that argument. They voted to go ahead with the trial. And six Republicans this week joined in. But I think we should stress that it's only six. That means that most Republican senators either thought that this was convincing or just didn't want to do the trial, didn't want to have to vote one way or the other to convict or not to convict, and so pretended that it was unconstitutional.
All the major news networks and cable news networks aired an unedited 13-minute film that was prepared by House managers showing graphic and disturbing details of the attack on the Capitol. The language included obscene chants by demonstrators as they surged toward and invaded the Capitol, and there were clear threats directed at Pelosi and Pence and others. Kimberly, I was in Washington. I was on Capitol Hill at that time, and it was difficult for me to watch it again and again and see all these new things. What were the most compelling moments of the presentation for you?
I think it's important to first acknowledge just how re-traumatizing this is for folks who were there, yourself, the members of Congress themselves, the staffers. In the testimony yesterday, there were quite a few videos showing just how staff had to run and hide. But for that first opening video, I mean, you can't escape the screams of the Capitol Police officer who's trapped in a door and being crushed as the mob pushes in a very coordinated fashion. Seeing people carrying a Confederate flag through the halls of the Capitol building, and this sort of awareness that you can, in some of the clips, see on the members of Congress's face as they begin their own evacuation. And I think there was a very good point that it is unlikely this is going to change the mind of many senators. But another purpose of this whole procedure is almost to set a historical record. And so I think the impeachment managers are definitely presenting this information with history in mind in terms of trying to create a narrative for how this time will be remembered, which is probably one of the reasons why Mitch McConnell has said to his Republican senatorial colleagues that this has to be a vote of conscience for each of them, because history will remember what they do.
Emily, what were the compelling moments for you in the House manager's presentation?
First, I would echo what Kimberly said. I can't imagine what it would be like to have lived through that day on Capitol Hill and then live through it again with this video presentation. And I don't want to not acknowledge that. What I will say is that it's not just about how horrible that day was, right? I think there's broad bipartisan consensus on that. What the trial is meant to do is show that Donald Trump incited an insurrection. And so for that reason, to me, a moment that really stuck out was in the opening video, watching one of the people who stormed the Capitol yell, "We're here for Donald Trump and you work for him." To me, just that clip alone kind of made the case, with the case being that Trump had incited this. The other moment that really stuck out to me from the first day was when Congressman Jimmy Raskin, who had lost his son on New Year's Eve and had buried him the day before, discussed how his daughter and son-in-law were there with him at the Capitol because they wanted to be together, and how his daughter afterwards said, "I'm not coming back here. I'm not coming back to the Capitol," because he had promised them it would be safe and it wasn't. From a legal standpoint, that doesn't matter. But from an emotional standpoint, from a human standpoint, it certainly does.
You make the point, Emily, that the point of this trial is not to declare that there's something awful that happened that day, because there are any number of prosecutions that are pointing that out of the people who stormed the Capitol. There are federal prosecutions and trials that are ongoing for this investigation of that. I think there's the key thing of trying to prove that Donald Trump incited this by his actions, not only on that day, but in the months leading up to January 6th. Kimberly, I'll go back to you. As you looked at the evidence of the things that happened before that day and the tweets that the president sent out on that day when the House managers reconstructed the timeline of things, do you think that that case is compelling? I'll pose it just like Emily did. Is it compelling to the senators, and is it compelling to the public at large?
I think that people both in the Senate and in the public are so entrenched in a predetermined outcome here that I don't know how many minds it's going to change. I mean, I think we've seen exactly one Republican senator change their mind through this process. It is a compelling argument. It's very clearly laid out by the House impeachment managers, who are the ones presenting all this evidence. There is a very clear timeline. And at one point in the testimony, I believe yesterday, you could see people in the Capitol who were in the process of destroying and hunting for members of Congress reading aloud Trump's tweets or responding in real time in the crowd, outside and in, to what President Trump was saying. It's a very clear argument. I don't know that it's going to change minds in terms of how the senators will vote, even if it changes their mind on whether or not they think he has responsibility for what happened. There are just so many political elements at play that are shaping what these senators do, because, again, they have to go back to run for election based on members of the Republican Party, regular Republican voters who are still very, very much in support of Donald Trump.
Indeed. We're going to get to that more in a minute. I want to talk a little bit about the two legal teams who are representing the different sides of the case here. We have the House managers led by Representative Jamie Raskin and the team that's led by Bruce Castor, Trump's team of Bruce Castor and David Schoen. Emily, in your opinion, or from what you are hearing, how have they fared so far in the court of public opinion, also with their audience, especially the Trump team, which would be the former president, Donald Trump?
As Kimberly said, I think the House impeachment managers have outlined as clear a case as they could outline. That doesn't mean that they're going to get Trump convicted, but they've very clearly presented the facts of the matter at hand. The Trump team has gone in a different direction. I would describe Bruce Castor's opening argument as long and rambling. He spoke at great length about how senators are extraordinary, gallant people. And I am not the only one who reportedly thinks the opening argument was long and rambling. Reportedly, the president was very upset by Castor's opening performance. David Schoen, who's the other lawyer, was sort of more direct, angry, also spoke at great length in the opening arguments. Neither one of them seemed to really have a succinct argument to present. It's also possible that that doesn't matter and that they know it doesn't matter.
Very good point. Kimberly, before we go to break, I'm going to pose the same question. Your thoughts on the two teams of attorneys, how they've performed so far. What was your feeling on how they have performed? And what do you think the Trump defense will be? Will it be a set case that does not depend on what the House managers have presented? Or will they adjust their case because of things that you're seeing now from the House managers?
Well, I mean, even members of the GOP, as Emily said, just thought that opening statement by Trump's defense attorneys was a mess. It was unfocused. And you had people like Trump supporters like Chris Christie and many members of the GOP just very confused at what they were trying to accomplish. Even some of the staunchest pro-Trump television networks cut away from it. But I think that the argument that Trump's lawyers are going to make is probably going to be very similar to the argument that we heard in the Russia investigation and impeachment as a result, that the Democrats are just out to get Trump. It's all a conspiracy. And the problem is that, as was just mentioned, they don't have to make that strong of an argument for all of the political considerations that we've laid out, unless there is a pretty seismic shift in what we're hearing from Republican senators. Trump's lawyers don't actually have to do that much. It's worth noting how hard it was for Trump to find lawyers to represent him in this case. It wasn't exactly the most sought after position in the legal world.
That's a very, very good point. It normally is a very sought after and esteemed position to represent a former president of the United States in the well of the U.S. Senate. And somehow that position was difficult to fill, as you note. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Emily, it's been noted already on the show that only six Republicans voted with the Democrats to go forward with the trial, and there would need to be 17 Republican votes in order to convict the president. Again, given the continued popularity of Trump with Republican voters and the new tolerance and even embrace of QAnon and other fringe groups by GOP legislators, is conviction even in the realm of possibility?
I mean, everything is within the realm of possibility. So I would never, after the past several years, I would never say that that couldn't possibly happen. I would be very surprised, though, if 17 Republicans decided to convict. You know, they're politicians and they're very aware of what the game here is. Now, I would note that recently, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who was the only Republican who switched his vote to say, yes, let's proceed with the trial. So he was the only one who was apparently convinced by the impeachment manager's opening argument. He recently put out a video that said to the Nebraska GOP, you can censure me, that's fine, but I did better in this state than Trump did. So it's not like there's nobody who's making the opposite political calculation, but there's one person. So it's almost nobody.
But if I can add on to that bit about political calculation, I mean, I have to imagine that there is a Republican fantasy that if they could get enough Republicans to convict Trump, that they could release his hold on the party. He has the email lists that are very valuable to politicians. He has the sway over the party. He's got his own political action committee. And so one of the other political calculus elements that has to enter this is if they do not convict him, what control he's going to continue to have over the Republican Party into the future. And is that what something that the GOP is willing to accept?
Emily, as we close out the topic, and an interesting turn of events, I think, both conservative media and the Biden White House have been spending very little time talking about the Senate trial. What has been the Biden position on the trial so far? And by the way, muted on Twitter, what is Donald Trump thinking?
I think that Biden, in fact, I know that, Biden, because he said it, that his position on this is, I have a job to do. There's a pandemic. There are people out of work. There are people who need to be vaccinated, and I'm going to focus on that. I think that had there not been an attempted insurrection, that Biden would not have spent his opening days, the opening days of his administration, talking about or dealing with Trump. But Trump supporters forced this administration's hand. I think that Democrats in the House felt like they had to impeach based on what happened. And so Biden, I think, is trying to walk the line of, okay, this is happening, but also while it's happening, we're going to get my people confirmed in the Senate and into their jobs, and we're going to try to push through legislation to help people dealing with this continuing deadly pandemic. Trump, I have to say, I've seen some people who are like, oh, I wish he could just tweet just for the day. And while I do not share that wish, another difference between this and the first impeachment is that we don't have this unfiltered look into the president's mind because he's not watching TV and tweeting about it. That doesn't mean that he's not watching TV and fuming about it based on reports of his dissatisfaction with Bruce Castor. But I think both for Biden and for conservative media, the thing that they have in common is that they would both rather focus on something else.
Well said. Again, I will finish with you, Kimberly, on this one. Let me just suggest a proposition that there is an acquittal. The Senate does not vote to convict Donald Trump. And also, the House has had its opportunity to put it on record what has happened and to clearly position the role of the president in inciting the events of January 6th. Is that an outcome that could possibly bring some sort of bridge or begin some sort of unification or healing process? Or is this just bound to be another wedge in what is already a divided country?
I doubt that it's going to appeal to unity. But I also don't think it's going to have much of a difference in terms of creating an additional wedge. The wedge is already there, and the work of unifying the country is going to be a tough task regardless, because a lot of these calls for unity are asking Americans to unify with people who are avowed white supremacists or people who did raid the Capitol and try to kill members of Congress, who did try to overthrow the government. And so calls for unity are falling a bit on deaf ears on the left because they, in many cases, don't want to unify with those types of people. Calls for unity, at least on the far right, for the same reason, they want to pursue these extreme agendas. Now, for the vast majority of Americans who are in the middle, I think it's going to really depend on what we hear from the two parties. How do the Republicans try to shape the narrative in a post-Trump era? The Democrats, are they able to achieve some of the goals that they've laid out while they have very narrow control of both Congress and the White House? So this question of unity is a little bit fuzzy on the edges.
Indeed. I'd like to move on to our COVID-19 segment. The Biden administration is ramping up its efforts to bring the COVID-19 virus under control, utilizing the Defense Production Act to mobilize increased production and distribution of the vaccine. Rates of infection and hospitalization are down, but continued super spreader events and the emergence of new virus strains mean that the pandemic seems far from over. Emily, is the Biden administration fulfilling its promises to deliver a million or more vaccinations a day? And is that enough to bring it to the point where we can sort of visualize life as normal?
Vaccination production and distribution, that has increased, but is it enough? Just to be very honest, I don't know. I live in DC, and every morning we get these emails saying, okay, there are new vaccines. Oh, sorry, the vaccines have actually run out, and we just don't have enough vaccines. And I mentioned this to my family who lives in New York, and they said, oh, they say the same thing here, that there just aren't enough of them. So there are a few things here. One, we just don't have enough vaccines being distributed efficiently enough for every person in this country right now. And two, and I think I've said this on the show before, it's not just about the federal government provides for all these vaccines. It's also, okay, how are we coordinating with state and local governments to distribute them to people? We all need them, but to the elderly, to frontline workers, do teachers get them? Do restaurant workers get them? I would just bring this back to the previous discussion by saying that to the extent that there's going to be unity, I personally don't think it's going to come from any political argument. It will come if people's lives are made better. For the majority of people in this country who I think do not follow politics, maybe as closely as people tuning into issues in the news, that getting out of this pandemic and recovering the economy, that will be the thing that kind of brings us back from the edge. To be honest, it's as yet unclear whether the Biden administration will be able to do that.
a big part of recovery means economic recovery, and the negotiations on the $1.9 trillion package proposed by Biden has some controversial components, like an increase in the minimum wage. There are large amounts of money for states that have been characterized as bailouts by some Republican politicians. Kimberly, the package as it stands now, the Biden administration has indicated that it has some flexibility, but not much, in what they want to do and how they want to implement that package. Where does it stand now, and when are we likely to see this legislation approved and funds actually going out the door?
Well, this was actually one of the reasons that the Biden administration was a little bit hesitant about how to go about impeachment proceedings, because they want to move this legislation through as quickly as possible. There's a very narrow majority for the Democrats, well, actually no majority for the Democrats in the Senate to pass this kind of legislation if it's a 50-50 split and the vice president is going to have a tie-breaking vote. And so what that means is that while the Democrats can technically move through the legislation as they want to, it's on a razor's edge. And so the Biden administration has said they are open to hear Republican options, but they will go it alone. There can be tweaks along the edges at the moment. They're sort of hammering out some of the language of it. But when is this aid going to get out the door? Too late is always the answer, because this is aid that small businesses and Americans needed a long time ago. Schools are actually pretty crucial for the reopening plan. We're supposed to hear from the Biden administration this week on their strategy for the safe reopening of schools, because this is one of the things that has really held back the economy, the additional burden on working parents, especially women who are having to manage remote schooling of children or having to manage childcare while also trying to work. We've had massive numbers of women leaving the workforce and cutting back hours just because there is no backstop for them. So this aid needs to get moving as soon as possible. They're working on it, but it's a little challenging for senators and members of the House to push through legislation while everyone's eyes are on these impeachment proceedings.
Safety, recovery, the economy, all of these things are so closely linked when it comes to this pandemic. Before we leave, I just wanted to mention a quick note about the military coup in Myanmar. The military is now back in charge and has declared a year-long state of emergency. It seized control on February 1st, following a general election in which Mrs. Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party won by a landslide. The armed forces had backed the opposition, who were demanding a rerun of the vote, claiming widespread fraud. The election commission said there was no evidence to support these claims. Many officials are now under house arrest. They've been detained. I just want to ask just sort of a one-minute existential question, sort of an instinctual question of each of you, which is, in your opinion, I'll start with you, Kimberly, do you feel that the events that happened on January 6th at the Capitol have emboldened certain factions around the world to use the claim of election fraud to seek and pursue their own political ends around the world?
Yes, and I think the entire Trump administration, the 4 years of Trump, did that as well. You heard dictators all over the world echoing the language of fake news and don't trust the press, and stolen elections definitely has picked up. In many ways, the way that Trump ran the United States government did show what not only could be done and how these narratives could be manipulated, but also what the United States might tolerate and turn a blind eye to in ways that they hadn't done before. And I think this is part of the work that the Biden administration is trying to begin to do, which is reset the expectations of the role the U.S. plays in the world and what the U.S. government will and will not turn a blind eye to.
And Emily, I'll pose the same question to you. Has the U.S. been a negative influence on democracy in the world?
I would say yes, although I also think it's important to note that issues in Myanmar predated the Trump administration. I would say that looking forward, the challenge is, now that you've had 4 years of Trump, and also now that you have a military that just staged a coup that's clearly not interested in language about democracy and human rights, what do these U.S. tools do, right? Biden announced new sanctions on Myanmar and promised more measures. Okay, and if they don't listen, then what? What has American rhetoric and American threats, how powerful or powerless are those after 4 years of what we've had?
Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Thanks to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. This program is produced by The Voice of America, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, host of this edition of PC USA. February is the month that Americans have designated as Black History Month, a time to recognize the historic contributions of African Americans to the culture and landscape of American history. In this show, we will explore the movement of over 6 million African Americans out of the rural southern United States to cities in the Northeast, Midwest, and West between 1916 and 1970. This movement is known as the Great Migration. While most people are only aware of two major historical periods when discussing African American history, the 246 years of enslavement that ended after the Civil War was over, and the dramatic years of the Civil Rights Movement that was highlighted with protests and riots. However, there is more to the story of African Americans. In a History Channel documentary titled The Great Migration, it was noted that by the end of 1919, some 1 million Black people had left the South. Prior to this, from 1780 to 1910, more than 90% of the African American population lived in the American South. By the end of the Great Migration, just over half of the African American population lived in the South, while a little less than half lived in the North and West. The escape from Southern oppression gave hope to African Americans that they would have a say in democracy, put a spotlight on the injustices of the South, and allow their children to have a better life. In the second Great Migration, which began in 1940 and lasted until 1970, some 5 million African Americans migrated to the Northwest, Midwest, and even West to obtain skilled jobs in the defense industry in cities such as Los Angeles, Oakland, Phoenix, Portland, and Seattle. After the Civil Rights Movement, the trend reversed with African Americans moving to the South. Though the movement was not on the scale of the Great Migration, many African Americans have presently chosen to live in the South due to job growth, a lower cost of living, family ties, improved race relations, and a warmer climate. Well, joining me to discuss the historical phenomenon of the Great Migration is historian Jesse Holland. He is also an author, journalist, TV personality, and professor of media and public relations at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Also joining me is my colleague, Chris Simpkins, VOA's award-winning senior TV correspondent, who is also an author himself, and he has produced numerous feature works on the struggles and contributions of African Americans. Welcome again, both Jesse and Chris, to Press Conference USA.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
Well, first of all, I just want to look at the overall picture of this Great Migration. How significant to American history was it?
Well, if you look at the Great Migration as far as a time period, we know that a lot of it actually begins directly after the Civil War. When the Civil War ended in 1865, newly freed slaves, if they could, left the South by the thousands. They left behind the life they knew in slavery and were hoping to begin a new life elsewhere. But quite a few of them also stayed in the South, hoping to build lives as citizens of America during the Reconstruction period. But after the failure of Reconstruction, when the South started instituting its Black codes and its Jim Crow laws, many African Americans, frankly, realized that they would never be able to lead lives of equality, to be able to find jobs that equaled their intelligence, and frankly would not be able to hold any type of power over their own lives, whether economic or political. So they decided to pick up and leave and search for their American dream in other areas. And we saw a lot of that, especially from the part of Mississippi where I'm from. You saw a lot of people pick up and head to St. Louis or Chicago or Detroit. In that era, that's what we now know as the Great Migration, where African Americans gave up on the idea of economic and political justice in the South and began to leave and explore America and attempt to find those things elsewhere.
And Chris?
Yeah, that's right. Jesse, my grandfather, Jack Atkins, was an attorney. And in the early 1920s, he was a part of the Great Migration, moving from rural North Carolina to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, he arrived there in 1922, but at that time and before that, Tulsa was known as the Black Wall Street. Can you talk a little bit about that and talk about one of the darkest chapters, I think, in African American history that took place there 100 years ago?
Right. This is something that if you don't know about it, you should know about it. Tulsa, Oklahoma had an area that was called Greenwood. Now, back in this time, about 100 years ago, Tulsa, Oklahoma was a segregated city. But African Americans in Tulsa were actually prosperous. They had their own stores and their own banks and their own schools. But back in May of 1921, the white population of Tulsa, Oklahoma, behind an accusation that was never proven, a African American man assaulting a white woman on an elevator. The white Tulsans burned and killed and destroyed the entire neighborhood of Greenwood. I was lucky enough to be able to go to Greenwood maybe about 2 years ago in Tulsa. And to this day, Greenwood has never recovered from the race massacre 100 years ago. And of course, on top of everything else, now a major interstate runs directly through the middle of Greenwood, which will keep it from ever revitalizing. But it was one of those race massacres that destroyed African American prosperity in America. To this day, the people of Greenwood, the neighborhood of Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma, they've never recovered from the massacre 100 years ago.
Yes, that's a very, very tragic story. After reaching their new destinations, you had also mentioned, you know, moving up to, for instance, Chicago, African Americans were excluded from living in predominantly white neighborhoods of the North and Midwest with clauses written into deeds that prevented them from buying or leasing homes. And some, the only provision made was if the person was a servant. One notable example is Lorraine Hansberry's 1959 play, A Raisin in the Sun, about a Black family on Chicago's South Side living in a dilapidated housing project. This became the first play written by an African-American woman to be performed on Broadway. A film version was released, and to this day, the critically acclaimed movie is still very relevant. A Raisin in the Sun also told of the true life discrimination that was experienced by Lorraine Hansberry. Seeking a better life for his family, her father, Carl Hansberry, moved his family from the South to Chicago in the 1930s. Lorraine was 7 years old when they first moved, and she later described a mob descending onto the home, throwing bricks into the house and broken concrete, narrowly missing her head. And of course, there are countless similar stories to this, Jesse, but were African Americans surprised when they reached their destinations that they were not accepted openly?
But I can tell you some of the stories that I heard from my father, who was one of the ones who did not leave, who was not part of the Great Migration. He was one of the ones who stayed home in Mississippi while his brothers and his cousins left for cities like Chicago and Detroit. And I would always hear stories how these people who did migrate would come home with these cars and clothes and these fancy stories. But the reality was that while they were not in the South, some of the same treatments that they received in the South, they found in other places as well. At places like Chicago, places like Detroit. While there were jobs available in those cities, African Americans were still discriminated against and forced to live in certain neighborhoods and excluded from things like schools, political power, suburbs. While they did get away from the racism in the South, in the end, encountered even more racism in the North. Maybe not the exact same, but still the same forms of discrimination and economic exclusion that they face in the South. The only difference was in the South, there were no jobs that were not agricultural jobs for African Americans. In the North, African Americans did find the industrial jobs, but they still didn't find the political and the economic freedom that they were searching for.
Chris?
Yeah, I would like to add to what Jesse just said. And in addition to some of those challenges, new arriving migrants also encountered social challenges from the Black establishment in the North, who tended to look down on these folks coming from the South as less educated and kind of country manners, so to speak. Jesse, I was also wondering, were there attempts to stop the migration from happening? And what did the South look like during the height of this migration, especially in places like you said, Mississippi, where the state was left with just a massive loss of people? How did it impact those Southern states?
Well, what we saw from a lot of these Southern states were attempts to hold on to this a workforce that they could continue to exploit. Some states like Mississippi and Alabama started banning Northern newspapers like the Chicago Defender from being brought in the state that would tell stories of availability of jobs in the North. And many times, especially in the Deep South, many African Americans were forced to stay in a form of sharecropping, which was another form of economic slavery, where they would never be able to make enough money to pay off the notes that the white landowners would put on them for housing and for clothes and for food. They would be forced to live and work their entire lives without ever getting out of debt. So the Southern landowners, the people who were profiting from slavery, came up with new ways to keep this underpaid and sometimes undereducated workforce in the South, instead of allowing them to leave and seek their fortunes elsewhere in the country, like any other American citizen would have been able to.
This also leads right into my next question on the Jim Crow laws of the South. These were state and local laws that enforced racial segregation in the South. Can you tell me more about the Jim Crow laws and just the impact that this had on African Americans?
Well, Jim Crow laws were laws set up by Southern states whose only intention was to keep a growing African American population still in servitude. These laws led to things that we now know are called like sundown towns, which were towns where African Americans could not be in public after dark. These led to things like colored and white bathrooms and colored and white drinking fountains and discrimination on public transportation and discrimination on the job. Jim Crow laws were another attempt by the descendants of white slave owners to keep the African American population in a position where they would have no power. Jim Crow laws lasted for a very long time in the South, and we can still see some vestiges of Jim Crow laws even in our laws today. There are people, lawyers and civil rights advocates out there who are still fighting against some of the vestiges of Jim Crow law today.
And on that note, let's take a short break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jesse Holland, historian, author, journalist, TV personality, and professor of media and public relations at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Also joining me is Chris Simpkins, VOA senior TV correspondent. I'm Kim Lewis. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Collins Dilichukwu of Enugu, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. We now return to our program, The Great Migration of African Americans and How It Shaped the Political, Social, and Cultural Landscape of America. My guest is Jesse Holland, along with VOA's Chris Simpkins. Chris?
Jesse, I wanted to ask you about the tensions that were created with the migration, whereas you had Blacks living in the South where they made up a good majority of the population moving to these areas to the North and Midwest and West where they were mixing with whites. And at that time in cities like East St. Louis, for instance, and other cities, there was racial riots, were there not?
There were racial riots all over the North as the previous populations of these cities saw African Americans come up to the cities and begin to work and to acclimate themselves to their new environments. But there was a tension also with African Americans in the South who saw their sons and their daughters and their cousins and their grandchildren leave their ancestral land and go off and frankly never come back. So there was always a tension between the African Americans who stayed in the South and attempted to make their lives in the South better and those who picked up and left and come back with stories of a life that those left behind could not even conceive. So there's always been that tension. In fact, I actually wrote a little bit about that in a new comic book I did for DC Comics this past month called Represent. In a chapter called Heritage, I talk about my leaving the South. Now, I know we're talking more about the people who left in the 1920s, but I left the South as well, where my parents still live today on the farm where my father grew up. There has always been these type of tensions between those who leave and those who stay behind. And I think that's partly why we see more African Americans returning to the South these days. As I've always told everyone who knows anything about me, that I also intend to return to the South because that's my ancestral home place. But when I was growing up, there were no opportunities that I saw that were available for myself, so I felt like I had to leave as well. And once again, those type of decisions cause tension, but that's the way of the world.
Jesse, you said your parents decided not to leave and to stay in Mississippi. How were their lives over the years in living in Mississippi?
Well, I will tell you, and they're probably better to speak to this than I am, but I will tell you that my parents were both very industrious. They both were public school teachers as well as farmers. They both got their master degrees from colleges and universities. So they both were able to achieve their goals and their dreams. And they have four children, all of whom got their master degrees. So I think my parents will tell you that they had a good life. They were able to achieve what they wanted to achieve without sacrificing the things that they believed in. Now, I will also just briefly say that my parents also left. My parents left Mississippi for 1 year to move to St. Louis, Missouri, but they immediately returned back to Mississippi to the place where they live today. There are some people whose roots are deep in the soil of the South, and my parents were some of those people. And that was one of the things that I always admired about them. They knew who they were and where they wanted to be, and they made their lives exactly the way they wanted them.
Well, it's nice to hear a positive story in terms of what we've been talking about. Between 1910 and 1930, the African American population increased by about 40% in northern states. The cities of Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, Baltimore, and New York City had some of the biggest increases in the early part of the 20th century. Tens of thousands of Blacks were recruited for industrial jobs, such as positions related to the expansion of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Many of these cities today suffer from unemployment, high crime, police killings of unarmed African Americans, and even biases in housing, healthcare, and education. So what happened over the years that caused this downturn?
Well, you will hear a lot of different reasonings for what we call that downturn. You'll hear the loss of the industrial base, as many of the factory jobs that African Americans moved to the North to get vanished. We always hear stories about Detroit and its incredible auto industry, which is decimated today with many of those same autos being made overseas. We always talk about the loss of the agricultural South, but many of the cities where African Americans escaped the agricultural South from ended up being decimated during the loss of the industrial factories of the North. And when you remove the economic base of a city, then remove the ability of people to find new jobs, you're going to end up with what we saw in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which was a loss of an economic and political base for a new immigrant population, which was African Americans. So already being forced to live in the poorest neighborhoods, which had the poorest education system, and then losing the industrial base that brought them there, forcing them to live in an area where they have no jobs, no money, no education, is no surprise that these areas deteriorated in the way that they did. And some of the areas are still trying to recover from the loss of that industrial base 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Chris, your thoughts?
I think Jesse is absolutely right. And I think a lot of this is really highlighted now because of what we've seen with the massive economic downturn, the coronavirus pandemic, and that you have many African Americans in big cities, including here in Washington, that are still subjected to living in large public housing blocks and otherwise known as ghettos. There are high unemployment among African Americans, especially now that so many businesses have closed, especially those small Black businesses. Jesse, I was just wondering, do you think because of what we're seeing today, we might begin to see the beginnings of a bigger migration that reverses from the big cities back down to what Kim was mentioning, called the New South, where there seems to be more jobs and less of the violence and other social ills that African Americans have had to endure in our cities?
I do think you're going to see many changes over the next decade because of the coronavirus pandemic, especially as we improve internet access for everyone in the United States, where you're now no longer required to live in a downtown core to conduct downtown business, where you're no longer required to live two blocks away or three blocks away from the place you work. So I do think that, especially as we move forward on electronic communication, we'll see more African Americans moving to areas with a better education system, with a lower cost of living, and where they have a greater connection, an ancestral connection to the land. For example, we see all of these stories about cities like Atlanta blowing up like crazy, the Memphises, the Miamis, the Charlotte, North Carolinas. Those cities have increasing African-American population, not only African-American population, but middle-class African-American population because of the advantages those cities provide and having a pre-existing strong African-American core. I look at the stories that are told by authors like Isabel Wilkerson in The Warmth of Other Suns, and I can see 20 to 30 years from now, authors talking about the renaissance of the New South as African Americans leave cities where their parents and their grandparents arrived during the Great Migration and return down south to the states that their ancestors abandoned.
Well, I just wanted to mention those African Americans that migrated out to the West Coast. For instance, there was Mallie Robinson. She was the mother of five. She took her five kids, got on a train, and took from one train to another train to another train until she reached California with her five kids. And one of them was a baby in diapers. All of her kids, they went to integrated schools. And even though the house that she moved into, there was a cross that was burning on her front lawn. And one of her kids, named Jackie, would go on to earn four letters in athletics in a single year at UCLA. Later in 1947, he became the first African American to play Major League Baseball. Was life different out west than it was in other regions of the U.S. during this Great Migration?
Well, when African Americans moved out west, there wasn't the same industrial base that we saw in cities like Chicago and Detroit. There weren't the huge factories. There weren't the huge meat markets. There wasn't the huge auto industry. For example, there was, however, a great burgeoning defense industry in places like California. So many African Americans left Texas and Arkansas and Missouri and migrated across the country and moved to places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Oakland, Sacramento, Denver, Seattle. I remember being surprised when growing up when I found out that my grandmother's brothers had moved from Mississippi to Denver and Los Angeles. I didn't even know I had relatives in Colorado and California, but they made great lives for themselves. And when we visited them, I always remembered being surprised how they continued the same traditions that my grandmother had in Mississippi. So while these African Americans did leave the South, they brought parts of the South with them, with their family traditions, their family recipes, and some of the same religious practices that they practiced in the South. So while they didn't have the industrial background that the African Americans who moved to the Midwest and to the North had, they still found jobs in the defense industry, jobs in shipping, jobs in education, and were able to make decent lives for themselves.
Also, what would you say is the legacy of the Great Migration? And looking at the South now, where does it stand in terms of equality?
Well, even with African Americans having left the South in the thousands and thousands of numbers, if we look at the demographics today, Mississippi will still be the first majority Black state in the Union by demographics at some point in the next 20 to 40 years. Mississippi will become the first majority African American state in the Union. So we can see by those numbers that even though the Great Migration brought advantages to our grandparents and our great grandparents who left the South looking for economic and political power, they were successful. But now there's a reverse as more and more African Americans look South for those same things, for economic and political power. So I think while the Great Migration helped spread African Americans around the United States, as we go forward into the future, we'll see more African Americans look South again for their ancestral home places and return to the places where our ancestors began.
And Chris, would you like to add another question or comment as we wrap up the show?
Oh, I'd just like to say we talked about all of the hardships that Blacks had to endure with the Great Migration and some with even death. But I think one of the more positive aspects of the migration, and Jesse, would you not agree, was the explosion of African-American artists, songwriters, singers, band leaders. And I think about one of the artists, and if our listeners want to take a look, they should look up a great African-American artist Jacob Lawrence, who did a migration series back in the 1940s. I think you'll find some of this artwork fascinating in explaining and what he saw as a young person migrating from the South up to New York. And I'm just so happy that we saw with that great migration an explosion of culturalism that African Americans could spread throughout the country. Is that right, Jesse?
I 100% agree. Many things that migrated from the South along with African American were music like the blues, like jazz from New Orleans, like spoken word poetry and religion. These are things that began in the South with African Americans. And when they migrated out of the South, they became no longer Southern traditions. They became American traditions.
We'll end on that positive note. And I wanted to thank my guest, Jesse Holland, historian, author, journalist, TV personality, and professor of media and public relations at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and my colleague, thank you, Chris Simpkins, VOA senior TV correspondent. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Pikesville, Maryland. I'm Kim Lewis. Be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Palka. British Prime Minister